Tonight on Coast to Coast, the amazing mind of Dr. PhD type Clifford Pickover. We're going to be talking with him about his latest work, of course, called Sex, Drugs, Einstein, and Elves. And what a title for a book, but there's much more behind the title, as you'll see in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Cliff Pickover received his PhD from Yale University. He is the author of more than 30 books on such topics as computers, creativity, art, mathematics, human behavior, intelligence, religion, reality, time travel, alien life, and science fiction. He is a prolific inventor with dozens of patents and the associate editor for several journals as well. In addition, Cliff's computer graphics have been featured on the cover of many popular magazines and on television shows. His most recent book, Sex, Drugs, Einstein, and Elves, subtitled, listen to this, Sushi, Psychedelics, Parallel Universes, and the Quest for Transcendence, is part of memoir and part surrealistic perspective on cultural and science. He's our guest. What a title, Cliff. You even tongue-tied me.
Oh, thank you. I thought it would catch your imagination.
My God. Well, how did you come up with that?
Well, the book has a little bit of everything in it. It has the sex, the drugs, the Einstein, and the elves. And as you said, I've written about 30 books on the borderlands of science. And I always thought I was holding a little back. So in this book, I talk a little bit about my life. I talk about the fringes of culture and science, and I try to give readers a glimpse of new ways of thinking.
Transcendence.
Yes, transcendence.
That's
right.
It. Now, because you've done a lot of things. I mean, I'm just reading just a portion of some of the things that you have done. Your mind doesn't stop at all.
I think creativity, lateral thinking, this has always been part of me since, you know, many years. And in this particular book, I let my mind wander to all these different topics that they have a unifying theme where I'm trying to get the readers to, you know, peer beyond their ordinary reality. So, as you said, I touch on, you know, an array of topics from sushi to zombies to even Proust, the famous French novelist that gets you to think in new ways.
Is he the one that had an influence on your career, or are there other people as well?
Well, I think I have many diverse interests. I mean, I always admired some of the famous popularizers of science like Isaac Asimov and Carl Sagan and so forth. But like many people in science, I think we got kick-started as teenagers and even earlier by science fiction. You know, science fiction is the literature of change and tells us, you know, where we're poised on, you know, the possibilities that humanity might encounter in the next few years. So I think my influences are pretty diverse.
Yeah, I was fascinated with several things in your book. I mean, the whole book, of course. Several things really stood out for me. One was, of course, the section where you were talking about collecting brains. I want to talk with you about that. But also your belief system, because even though you write on some very interesting and strange topics, you are generally a skeptic at heart, aren't you?
Yeah, I'm a skeptic at heart. I'm a scientist at heart. You know, I've even written for probably America's premier magazine on skepticism, the Skeptical Inquirer. But on the other hand, I do have a mystical streak, as you can tell. And, you know, a lot of people ask me about religion and God and how do I bring those together into my mind. And I think the closest we can come is, you know, there are facets of the universe that I think we will have difficulty understanding, or perhaps we can never understand. And then you can reason this way. You know, a monkey's brain is not all that much different than a human brain, but a monkey can never understand calculus and black holes and logic. And with just a few ounces more of brain tissue, think of what we can think.
Today,
now, if you want to extrapolate where I'm heading, You know, there are probably thoughts we can never think because we are a bit limited by our own 3 pounds of brain tissue. So there's visions we might only glimpse, but it's at this filmy, veiled interface between, you know, our reality and some reality beyond that, that we may find the numinous, which some may liken to God. And so it's this sense of mystery that's in my life that I think helps propel me at these edges of science.
Today, researchers said that gorillas use tools. They apparently witnessed a gorilla using a stick to measure the depth of water before he tried to attempt to cross it. Now, you know, one would simply scoff at that for a moment, Cliff, and say, okay, a stick, big deal. But this is what is, this is supposed to be an animal that we as human beings never consider having the ability to think and reason. I think that's pretty dramatic, isn't it?
Yes, it does sound dramatic, and I don't think there's a necessarily a clear dividing line between humans and their predecessors and primates. I think there's a sort of a continuum of consciousness and intelligence. So, you know, we see that all around us. If we learn more about gorillas and chimpanzees and so forth, we see that they have a rich emotional life, can use tools. They might suffer because their vocal apparatus can't permit language in the same way we can. And, of course, our brains are different. But I don't think there's, you know, a necessarily a very sharp dividing line between us and them. It's a gradual change through evolution.
I'm going to talk with you tonight about alien life. I'm going to talk with you about time travel. I'm going to talk with you about intelligent design of the universe. But I got to ask you about this. Sushi?
Sushi. Right. Well, sushi is one of my stimuluses for the imagination. You know, French author Proust, who I talk about throughout there, he wrote a huge novel called In Search of Lost Time. And he has his stimulus. He can look at anything in culture, from train schedules to soap advertisements, and that would trigger profound ideas. For me, I think part of it is sushi. So the names on a sushi menu and their artful displays give me ideas from art to biology to Asian travel. And in the book, the sushi in metaphor goes further, and I talk about fugu sushi, which is that type of sushi that can be quite dangerous because it has a neurotoxin. And this neurotoxin may be the active ingredient in zombie powder that Asian witch doctors use. And so from sushi, it's a platform to step off into these other realms of mind and art. So forth.
Well, you know, the French writer that you write so much about in the book, he had that small segment on asparagus. And you know what? I'm not sure I'm ever going to eat asparagus again, not because it's not good and not because he makes it sound bad, because he doesn't. It's just that he makes it sound so wonderful, I don't want to get rid of it.
Yeah, Proust was a very interesting character. As you said, he could write endlessly on small subjects like, you say, asparagus. But he had that book, In Search of Lost Time, which was over 3,000 pages. Now, I don't know anyone who actually reads all the volumes of this work, but he just let his mind, you know, peer into all aspects of reality and nature and culture. But it's a little difficult to get through because some of the sentences were so long. I took one of them, cut it out of the book, and I believe it stretched about 13 feet, a single sentence. But Proust was a, you know, very unusual and interesting character.
Okay, you're a scientist at heart. So does that normally mean that you're a non-believer or you're looking for the truth, you just haven't found it yet?
Well, I'm definitely looking for the truth. And, you know, when we talk about, you know, if you're getting to the idea of God, you know, it all depends on how you define God, right? The scientist God might not be exactly the same as the God of the Israelites, the God of miracles who smites the wicked, you know, and answers all the prayers and parts the Red Sea and so forth. You know, scientists might also talk about the mathematical and physical parameters that permit life to evolve. And that's more of the God of order. So I'm interested in the whole range from the biblical God to the physicist God, and I haven't found the answer yet, but I'm always searching.
Well, let's use the parting of the Red Sea for just a moment, Cliff. You know, in explain one thing first. Why do some of us, and then we'll get into the reasoning behind it, Why do some of us look at that biblical story with the spiritual twist to it and hope for that? Because it is kind of neat to think that. And then why do some of us, like you, think of the scientific reason for why it may have happened? Why the difference?
Well, I think all of us want a sense of mystery in our life, a sense of justice, a sense of right and wrong and protection. We do want to think that there's a higher power looking out for us. Why am I interested in science so much? Hard to say. I guess I grew up with it, reading with it. But unlike a lot of scientists, I know I'm very interested in the Bible. And in some ways, I think of the Bible as almost an alternate reality device where it gives us a glimpse of other ways of thinking, other worlds. And to me, it's one of the most mysterious books ever written because we really don't know the precise ratio of history to myth. We don't know all the authors. We don't even know all the intended messages in the Bible. But for me, it's a way to sort of reach across culture and time, and it reflects some of humankind's deepest feelings.
See, some of us would have the feeling of faith and belief and take everything that's written in there under its contents, under its context, and then others will not. Others will simply say it's a great story. And somewhere in the middle maybe is the truth. I don't know.
Yeah, and I probably sit somewhere in the middle. You know, it's very hard for me to accept lots of beliefs based on faith alone because that's a little bit outside of science. You know, once you say, I accept it by faith, you kind of exclude some of the scientific experiments that we've come to use for testing the universe. And so, you know, if you let faith in for one religion, then how do you know where to start and stop to let all sorts of ideas into your belief system? But, you know, that doesn't stop me from pondering all this, and it seems like it doesn't stop you and your audience as well.
No, that's true. Okay, so you got a PhD from Yale, pretty good university. Tell me, what was the PhD in?
It was a PhD in molecular biophysics and biochemistry.
All right.
So and before that, I was in college. I majored in biology. I was first in my class and graduated in 3 years from a school called Franklin and Marshall College.
Oh, yes.
Then I got the PhD. Now I've gradually gotten more into computers over the last 10 or 20 years. And writing, you can see, is also evolved to be one of my main loves. And so when I have any leisure time, I'm there writing my next book and thinking about the publishing industry, and you know, I also try to help budding authors as well. So, you know, people can always reach out to me with questions on the writing life or any of the topics we talk about here at my website, pickover.com.
Okay,
and I welcome people.
With this great and strong experience in biology, do you believe that it's entirely possible that the kind of life forms we have on this planet are out there in the universe, on other planets?
Well, I definitely believe that alien life is everywhere because, you know, wherever we look on Earth, we see life in incredibly diverse environments. We see it living miles under the Earth in darkness or in ice or in boiling water. So that tells us that what seems to be possible in nature also tends to be realized. So I believe life, at least primitive life, is throughout the universe. Now, the question of technological and space-faring life, that's also another question we could pursue.
Well, I would assume if we have the kind of life that we have, that that intelligence would evolve, especially if some of these civilizations got a jump start on us. We being 4.5 billion years old, they could be 7-8 billion years older than us.
I think it's quite likely that there's intelligent life, but, you know, it's not necessarily inevitable, because if you look at life on Earth, there's about 50 billion species that arose, and only one acquired technology. So mammals, for instance, are not necessarily the most successful. If you look around, there's 95% of the species are invertebrates, or animals
right.
without backbones. And rats and beetles, you know, they don't have all that much intelligence, and they're quite successful, evolutionarily speaking. So, intelligence might be quite a hard thing to evolve, especially the type that can build spaceships.
I might be able to get you boxed into a corner on this one.
Okay.
Okay, because you're right. With all these different kinds of creatures on this planet, there's only one that has this so-called intelligence, even though, well, there might be two. I think the dolphins are pretty good. If they had arms, who knows what they could have been able to do, right? But, so it's just us. We're the only ones that evolved on this planet to do the kinds of things that we're doing. Nothing else could. That tells me that something else might have designed us. All these other things were like ancillary. They were part of the package. But human beings, with the minds we have, they were different. They were created for a different purpose. Maybe they came from a different place. I don't know, but I think we're different, don't you?
You're right. We are very special. And you touched on the idea of dolphins. You know, it seems like to build spaceships and have technology, you need two things. You need intelligence, and you need manual dexterity.
Yes.
You need to be able to manipulate. So we have very smart dolphins, but they can't manipulate their environment so well. And we have dexterous spiders. They can manipulate things well, but their intelligence, is not that high. And humans are special in that we have both the intelligence and the manual dexterity with our hands, for example, to be able to create.
You know, when you look at pure intelligence on this planet and you look at different human beings, some smarter than others, you, of course, in the title of the book, have the name Einstein. There's got to be a reason for that. How come?
Well, Einstein, his being and spirit is sort of suffused throughout the book. To me, he's a metaphor for a very creative thinker, obviously, and he revolutionized our understanding of space and time. You know, and in some sense, there's maybe never going to be another individual quite on par with Einstein as someone who's broadly recognized as an emblem of a genius. You know, today scientists are so extremely specialized that it's hard to imagine Einstein, who started out with almost no collaboration. And in fact, his special theory of relativity paper exactly 100 years ago today, he did all this stuff in 1905, that paper contained no references to the other prior work. And when he came to New York in 1921, thousands lined the street for his motorcade. Hard to think of a theoretical physicist now coming to America that the people are cheering.
True.
You know. So Einstein is really amazing because of that, and I think he affected the world. You know, the idea of Einstein is almost as important as Einstein himself.
Well, you know, you're into computers now. Can you imagine what Albert Einstein would be like today if he was proficient with computers and had the kind of computers that we have now?
Can you imagine science in general? If you took a modern personal computer and transported it back 100 years, what would that do to the world?
Oh, my gosh.
You know, it would change it. And what would it do to writers like Proust, the French writer? You know, this guy had to write in his bed. He gradually became a type of guy who stayed up all night and wrote and slept during the day in this cork-lined room. And he was continually editing by hand. Imagine him, you know, with a computer word processor, what he would do, or even people like Isaac Asimov, the science popularizer who wrote hundreds of books. How could he do it with just typewriters?
I know. Well, what about Da Vinci? If Da Vinci had the ability to have a computer, I mean, I'm convinced this guy was reincarnated from someone else around our time period, because what a mind he had.
Yeah, think of how technology is allowing us to really fly, even with the internet today. You know, if Da Vinci or Einstein had that, what new works would they create? What new collaborations would it allow them to have? You know, instead of waiting days and weeks and months and seconds, they could share their ideas with others. And Da Vinci would just, maybe he would be getting interested in computer graphics, for example, for some of his art.
Stay with us, Cliff. When we come back, let's chat a little bit about time travel and get your take on that. And, of course, I'm still going to talk about this intelligent design in the universe, because I just want to pick your brain. Cliff Pickover, we'll be back in a moment. Hey, my co-author Bill Burns is working with me on our first book together called Worker in the Light. It's about the world of the paranormal, and I think you're going to love that. It's up in New York with our publisher putting the final touches on that book. It took a long, long time, as a matter of fact. And, you know, talking to Clifford Pickover, he's written more than 30 books. I've got one coming out, and it's taken about 2 years. It's not easy. It really isn't. But I'll give you an update as soon as it gets close to when it's going to hit the old stand, okay? In the meantime, Perfect Possession is available to you. That's a free CD when you order the After Dark newsletter or renew your After Dark newsletter. A couple ways you can get to it. Call 1-888-727-5505. Go online, coasttocoastam.com. Perfect Possession is about exorcisms, and it's an Art Bell interview with the late Father Malachi Martin. And welcome back to Coast to Coast. I'm George Norrie with our guest, Dr. Cliff Pickover. Cliff, let's talk a little bit about time travel as one of the subjects of this hour. And then we'll, there's so much to talk with you about. You might be on with me for about 9 hours tonight. You ready for that? Do you think, first of all, that time travel is possible?
Time travel is definitely possible. It's not something that's just confined to science fiction. It is a fact, especially if we, clarify our meaning. You know, it seems like we live in a universe that has these three large spatial dimensions and one dimension of time. Thomas Aquinas thought that God was living outside of space-time so he could see all universes, the events, the past, and the future in one blinding instant. But we know time travel is real and possible in this sense. We know from Einstein that if you travel, you know, at high speeds and return to Earth, you will definitely travel into the future. You will age maybe days, but when you return to Earth, civilizations may have collapsed and evolved. Thousands of years could take place on Earth. It's because time is not something that Newton was thought pervaded a constantly throughout the universe, but it's affected by motion. And we also know that gravity affects time and causes it to slow. And there are many proposed time machines that make use of gravity and other possible properties of our universe that don't conflict with known laws of physics that would even permit backward time travel.
Do you think it's going to have to take equipment, technology to do it? Or is there probably some simple way right under our nose, we just haven't found it yet?
Well, one of the ways of creating a time travel device is to use wormholes. Now, we might be able to, in the future, someday be able to create these wormholes and use it for time travel. Or nature may have created some of these things that we can use ready-made for us. But backwards time travel is more speculative, but future time travel, we know there's so much evidence that the speed that you travel at affects the rate of time that, you know, that is certainly part of physics even today.
Okay, so let's jumpstart for a moment. Let's assume if time travel is indeed possible, I agree with you. I think it is too. Let's jumpstart 50 years from now, 100 years from now, doesn't really matter. Eventually, somebody in the future is going to invent real time travel, right?
I believe so, and I believe there's so much in our future because of the rate of technological progress that we have a very hard time predicting that. You know, after all, 10 or 20 years ago, who predicted the internet or the rise of the personal computer? Scientists are not too good at predicting the future, but we do know that the rate of change is so amazing today that there are incredible things that we'll be facing even in this century. If you look at all of human progress from the beginning of humans till now, we've had more progress probably in the last century than all the thousands of years before. And even in the last 10 years, there's been remarkable progress. And so the progress seems to be getting quicker and quicker and quicker, making it more difficult to predict, but a very exciting time to live in.
Okay, so let's assume 2036, they've perfected time travel, 31 years from now. Something dramatic happens, they've got it. Do you then think that those time travelers can either go into the future, 2038, 2050, or can they come back into time, our time period, and other periods?
Well, the challenge is, of course, if you time travel to the past, what paradoxes might you create? You know, the traditional one is if you go back and kill your grandmother, you know, would you cease to exist?
Right, right.
And many scientists speculate on the existence of parallel universes, and if you were to actually go back in time, you could do that, but you'd enter a different parallel universe or a different time stream, and the new universe you're in would march along. It wouldn't really affect the previous universe. So there are some escape hatches for these paradoxes.
Okay, now here's something I don't understand, Cliff. Maybe you can help me. How can you go back to an event that has occurred? I mean, if I'm writing with my pen and I put my pen down, it's done. It's over with. That whole image is gone. What is it about time travel that allows you to go back to those same events that occurred during that spot, that moment of time? I mean, is it like recorded in some kind of ether in the universe? Is that what's out there? Everything that's occurred, is it still there?
Well, according to one theory, if you went back, even to our beginning of our phone call, you would actually enter a different universe where Cliff and George were talking, and then another Cliff just entered, but the old universe would keep on going. But, you know, you raise a good point. There's something called the cumulative audience paradox, where, you know, if time travel were possible, why don't we see at the time of Jesus's crucifixion, you know, thousands of spectators lined up, stretching all through Arabia to Iran into Europe, you know, to see these grand events? We don't see thousands of people
yeah,
lined up, and, you know, we can wonder what that means.
Of course, we don't think we see them.
Right, and then, of course, someone who's extremely technologically advanced or even alien visitors to this world, you know, maybe they could do it in such a way where they wouldn't be perceived or they'd blend in. You know, if we liken it to a zoo, right, the best zoos are the ones that the animals are not so aware of all the observers watching them. And if Earth is a zoo for aliens or space or time travelers, you know, would they be advanced enough to shield their appearance as best as they could?
Maybe then that's where parallel universes come in, where every event is a separate universe and it's just always there. It never goes away.
Yeah, some of my favorite science fiction novels involve parallel universes, but physicists do think that parallel universes exist somehow side by side with our own in a ghostly manner. And you know, there's been surveys of the most brilliant physicists, and the majority do say that parallel universes are likely. Now, there's many different types we could discuss, but again, it's this idea of perhaps infinite universes similar to ours and very different that are existing side by side with our own.
Okay, so similar, we already know what they could be. What about different? What might they be like?
Well, let's talk about different types of parallel universes.
Right.
There's a scientist, Hugh Everett, who in the 50s said that at every instant due to quantum mechanics, the universe is branching. So when an electron decides to go one way or another way, it actually goes both ways and the universe branches. Now, you know, it could seem like a small effect, but what's the difference if an electron goes one way or another? What does that do to our world? But we know that the slightest changes can get amplified through time. And one analogy I like is, imagine a skin cell on the nose of beautiful Cleopatra. One little mutation by a random sunlight event will cause a growth on her nose, make her look ugly, and the whole cascade of human history would be different from that random electron, that random quantum change on the tip of her nose.
That one little thing.
Right.
Well, it's very possible. So these universes that could be out there, and there could be millions, billions, who knows? Why can't we see them with modern telescopes? Why can't we see what's next to us, for example? Are they next to us? You know, when we talk about the universe is expanding, and people, scientists have come on, physicists, they've given me the balloon theory, right, that the balloon expands. But I've always questioned it's expanding into something because you could see the balloon, what's on the other side. Might our universe and all these other universes be expanding amongst themselves?
Well, in some theories, the universe is constantly budding, creating these baby universes over and over again. Some theories say that these universes are inaccessible or very hard to access. However, other theories say that just a millimeter away, there may be these other universes separated from us in a different spatial dimension, and we may be able to see them by looking at gravitational effects, where, you know, light might travel just along our universe, and we can't get it to go hop to the next, but gravity may be able to impact and warp ours, and maybe we would be able to send signals just through gravity. This is one type of power of the universe. In the book, I spend a lot of time talking about realities that seem to be accessed through certain drugs. One in particular is called DMT, or dimethyltryptamine. And when people take this, they seem to enter an entirely new universe populated with beings.
Is that like in ayahuasca?
Yes.
Okay, that's right.
Exactly. What you just mentioned is an Amazonian brew made of plants that contain this DMT mixture. And the most fascinating thing that I found is that when users take this, they often, within seconds, enter these new universes. They're totally conscious. They have a total quality of awareness that's not warped. It's not melting like under LSD. And when they're there, they seem to see common themes. They see jeweled cities, sparkling palaces, and these elf-like creatures, which leads to the word elves in the title of my book.
Okay, could this be a vivid imagination, or could this really be going on?
I don't think, and this is now, I'm probably going to shock some of our scientist friends. I don't think it's simply a dream or imagination. The people who take DMT and see these, you know, whether they're in the Amazon or in New York City, they see such similarity of themes that I believe is telling us a lot. It's telling us either how the mind is architected, it's telling us about reality, because after all, we see reality through our mind, so what we learned about the mind tells us a lot about reality. And I hope more research is done in the future to see if any information can be gained from these beings, whether they're totally generated by our mind or they have some independent existence from our minds. It's something I think we need more research on.
Well, what happened to the skeptic scientists here?
I am skeptical. I am saying we should do research, and there have been researchers like Dr. Rick Strassman who, you know, actually gave DMT doses in a clinical setting to see what they would see. You know, do they see these things called machine elves that seem to be tending the fabric of reality?
Interesting.
You know, we do seem to have DMT as part of our brain naturally in small amounts, and it seems to be throughout some of the plant kingdom. Whether or not we're actually accessing something real or not, it's hard to say, but we certainly are accessing something interesting, and it's almost as if the human mind is engineered to build and to create these palaces, and the DMT is almost tearing away these blinders, revealing something about the architecture of our mind and reality.
Cliff, I've got an advanced copy of your book, therefore, you know, doesn't have the printed cover on it yet or anything like that, but there is a little picture of of what I think will be the cover. Is that what it will be like?
Picture of a woman and a DMT
something.
Molecule and
yeah,
DNA.
That's it. Okay.
Right.
And I see the crystal little things around her. That's just what you've described.
Yes, you see the chemical structure of DMT right on the cover there. You know, and DMT affects the mind. In the book, we can discuss later how unusual psychiatric disorders affect the mind. And in some sense, you know, people say, well, Cliff, isn't it obvious that DMT is just a hallucination? But there's no guarantee that humans were evolved or engineered to see reality as it truly is. You know, after all, just a few chemical differences in our brain, and we see reality very differently. One researcher who did fascinating research with mice actually inactivated a normal gene in the mouse that held the mouse back, and now, because of the inactivation, the mouse had a super sense of smell, 1,000 or 10,000 times as sensitive.
And was healthy, nothing went wrong with him, right?
And the mouse's behavior, everything seemed to work. So if humans have these reality-restricting genes, I like to ponder, maybe a God applied brakes by giving us these genes until we were sufficiently advanced to remove them. Just like the mouse, you remove the gene, it senses, smells 1,000, 10,000 times more. What are humans held back from sensing? What is there about the universe that we can't understand and sense, but that we have the capacity to? Maybe we need augmentation with computer interfaces and mathematics and even literature and poetry to help us tear away some of these veils.
Well, you know what? I agree with you. There should be some heavy research into this. I mean, has there been, other than this experiment on mice, has there been any done on humans that you know of? Anything?
Well, there's been this DMT research on humans by a number of researchers. And again, the remarkable thing is, why do people from different walks of life, different countries, different expectations, no expectations, why do they see these sparkling palaces that are so interesting?
I mean, so they see this in research. These aren't just people who take
right, DMT. These are people who are administered doses
okay,
in a clinical
okay.
setting.
All right, I thought
and
these were people who were like in Brazil.
It's both. Just,
okay.
It's everything. It's people in hospitals who are given doses. It's people in New York City. It's people in Brazil. They see these things that remind you of the New Jerusalem and the New Testament, these sparkling cities, or even, you know, Oz and the Wizard of Oz.
Yeah. Well, what if they're time traveling? Maybe they're seeing actual cities in the future. Possible?
Yeah, In fact, I talk about that in the book. I mean, our sense of time is so influenced by our mind and by drugs and even by hypnosis affects our understanding of time. And while on these drugs, certainly time seems to flow differently. And even in dreams, there's time dilation where little external time can take place, but it seems like hours and hours can be crammed into our dream life. How is that possible with the mind?
What is it about this DMT? What is it about this drug that allows people to see this in people, you know, very similar sights? Why can't we do it without it?
Well, it's as if it's releasing something. It's freeing the mind to see these things.
I see.
And, okay. You know, termites are engineered to create these intricate, very intricate mounds. And spiders create webs. And these things called bower birds, they construct nests with feathers and berries and shells. It's almost as if humans were designed to create, to build, to be attracted to sparkling, glittering gold. And under DMT, that all comes out. You enter these vast palaces. And in many ways, the DMT universe is superimposed on our own. Like I could, and there's different levels of blending. For instance, I could see one of these elf-like creatures on a tree branch that exists in our world, but the elf is in the DMT world. Or you can enter a completely new universe and walk through it and not even bump into things in our world. But you can explore these sparkling palaces. It's amazing that a few molecules of this drug can, you know, allow this. Now, of course, all these drugs are powerful. We don't necessarily tell people to go out and use them. They're illegal. Anything this powerful can be dangerous. But I think definitely we need to have much more funded research on it.
Oh, I agree. But why is it illegal? Because it is so powerful, or because there's another reason?
Why are any drugs illegal? Why is marijuana illegal? You know, I talk about that, and I, you know, right now I'm also going to publishers with new books. No publisher yet, so if there's any publisher listening, that talk about our minds and some of the topics that we're talking about in Sex, Drugs, Einstein, and Elves. I'm taking them a step further in these future books. You know, sometimes you look at the drug laws in America and you wonder, you know, Carl Sagan, the famous scientist, he used marijuana and wrote fantastic books. he just said it influences creativity.
All right, stay with us, Cliff. We'll be back with you another hour. Two more to go, as a matter of fact. I'm George Norrie, back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM.